Hey all, it's the No Nay Never podcast with your host, Jamie Smith.
Hello and welcome to this week's No Nay Never podcast. First podcast we've done for a couple of weeks, and there has been a bit of news to start with. We are now an award nominated podcast. We're up for a football blogging award, and we'll go through that in a bit more detail later in the podcast. But we will start with the football, and it was another home defeat for Burnley, I'm afraid. A 3-1 defeat at home to West Ham, but at least we scored another goal. Guest today on the podcast, Kevin Robinson. He's delighted with that goal, and Nathan Rogers. Kevin, we'll start with you then. Burnley just didn't take the chance in the first half, did they? And that's what cost us.
Definitely not. I thought we were, throughout most of the pitch, I think we were close to outstanding in the first half. We ripped them to shreds, particularly George Boyd was a real thorn in their side, and we created so many chances. We had so much possession. It was really smart possession as well. We were building in very much the same way which we did last season, which I think we've struggled to do so far. I think we've been pushed too far back for most of this season. But I think against Leicester, we showed signs that we were trying to build a bit more as we were used to last season. And particularly on Saturday, we were building much more of a team. Rather than sending just one or two players up, we were pretty much going forward as the whole team. And I have really no idea how we didn't score in that first half. Both the strikers had a few chances, particularly Djokovic. I think he had three or four really good chances, which he should have really got on target at least, but he didn't. And then second half, that first goal killed it for me. And then the second one, it was game over. And to be honest, I think that first win's looking, even despite how strong our first half was, I think our first win's looking further away than ever for me.
I think it's a difficult one to assess in a way, because we did play so well in that first half and there were a lot of positives to take from it, but it's not usually a good sign if you're going to play well and then lose. So although West Ham are a good side, and we do need to give them a bit of credit for killing us off at the start of the second half, I agree. I think it's concerning that we're not getting a result when we're playing like that. Nathan, what was your assessment of the game?
Yeah, kind of same as Kev, really. It was just a bit frustrating to watch. There were so many nearly chances, and but you know, in that first half an hour, George Boyd and Trippi were putting in some amazing crosses, and it baffled me to how Djukovic and Ings didn't latch onto anything. And it was just quite frustrating to watch, really. And the fact that we didn't get an early goal that might have set us up for the rest of the game, it just kind of, we were the creators of our own downfall, really.
The reaction after the break was so strange. I mean, because we've been on top so much for the first half, I suppose it was inevitable that West Ham were going to be improved. But for us to concede two goals within 7-8 minutes after the break, two well-made goals. But again, defensively, from crosses, we just look a bit all over the place, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the goals that were scored against us were two high-quality headers, really. They were just, you know, Tom Heaton had no chance of saving them, but defensively there was no marking towards the strikers whatsoever, and that was just a bit concerning, really. I thought having Duff and Shackle at the start of the season, I thought that would be really good pairing. You know, they know each other really well, and they've just not been able to kind of step up, I think, in that area. So yeah, I need to work on that.
I think the concern for that with me is really weird, because last season we were so strong defensively. This season, obviously, we're going to concede a lot more goals in the Premier League, but we're not being, the goals we're conceding at the moment are not just, we're not being outplayed as such. It's not like, you know, in the Chelsea game where you have that incredible pass by Fabregas and some more just outstanding play, which was just, that was, you can't really defend against that. It was just top class attack. It's the real simple stuff, just like, you know, defending corners and defending crosses. I think that's a frustrating thing for me, is because we've gone from such an organised defence to one which is just getting the basics wrong.
I'll tell you what's strange. We had that run of clean sheets and looked like we were going to grind out a lot of draws. And then we had all the injuries. But the injuries haven't affected the defence. We've been able to put out the same defence, even with all the players missing everywhere else. Yet, in the last three games, we've conceded 9 goals. Now, I do think one of the factors in that is that Dean Marnie's been injured. I think he provides a lot of protection from midfield. But defensively, Nathan, have you got any idea as to why we've been so much poorer in the last three games at the back?
Honestly, I do think it comes from Dean Marnie, like you just said. I think he is he's one of them players that, you know, when he's not in the team, you do suffer. Like, he is willing to make a foul when some players aren't willing to. You know, he's willing to get himself booked for, you know, to prevent that attacker going through the mid, through into the defence. And, you know, the defence have really struggled with not having anyone in front of them to kind of rely on. You know, especially with, like, experienced heads like Matty Taylor and Reid not really playing much. They've kind of struggled in, you know, that gap between midfield and defence. And I think that's just cost us in just the goals we've conceded.
We certainly missed Dean Marnie when he was injured last season. I think our worst spell of the season was sort of November, December time, wasn't it? And that coincided with Marnie's run being out of the team. So perhaps there's something there. Just on Matt Taylor, by the way, you mentioned Matt Taylor there, Nathan. He's had an operation. I think it's been an Achilles problem that's kept him out for the last few weeks, but he seems to have had an op today, and it's been a success, apparently. So hopefully he'll be back sooner rather than later. Kevin, what's your take on the defensive protection issue?
I'm not sure about it being Marnie. I think we definitely look a much weaker team with Dean Marnie in the team, and it's something I did talk about when you was first out, is that I think we'd miss that protection he gives to the defence. It's something I said against Leicester as well. After the Leicester game, I said that I think him being out there, being out of the team, does what was a big factor in is conceding goals. But if you look at a lot of the goals we've conceded while he's been out, I don't think there's anything what he could have really done to stop those kind of goals. I mean, you've got the corners against West Brom. I don't think Dean Marnie and the team is not going to, that's not going to stop but the calls, Jason Shackle and Tom Heaton getting in a completely mess of the corners. Similarly against West Brom, against West Ham, sorry, he might have had a bit of an impact in the build-up play, but the actual mistakes we were making in defence is not something what his him being there or not being there is going to change, I think. And, you know, you can make the argument that with him in the team and the defence comes under less pressure, but when West Ham scored their goals, the defence hadn't been under pressure. They'd probably had two or three chances all game at that point, so it's not like we were, you know, facing a flurry of chances against us because Marnie's out. And I think the midfield did cope quite well. To summarise, I don't think Marnie being out is the biggest cause for our defensive woes at the moment.
Yeah, I think if you assess the goals individually, yeah, I think you're right, Marnie probably wouldn't stop them, but I think some of the goals we've conceded have been as a result of pressure building, and we've not been able to release it, and I think that's where Marnie helps. All three of the goals were from crosses on Saturday, so I suppose that is highlighted as an issue, but two of them were from crosses from deep as well as the opposition fullbacks. We seem to be conceding far too many from crosses anyway, but is it a... I don't want to single out Ben Mee particularly, Nathan, but a lot of the goals do seem to come from his side. It was one each on Saturday, so not particularly his fault, but stopping crosses is an issue on both sides of the pitch, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of... I kind of forgot about Ben Mee over the past few games. I think other performances have kind of overridden Ben Mee's performance, but it kind of stood out a little bit against West Ham. It was a bit behind the pace, it felt, at times. It looked like he were... he was just like one or two steps behind every time, and, you know, and I think he slipped about four or five times as well, which is a bit worrying. I don't know if he needs to get new boots or they need to sort out the grass or the turf or something, but you know, it doesn't look good viewing when he's on the 6-yard line and he's falling over his own feet. But yeah, I think something needs to be done there, corrected with that. Yeah,
that one was particularly poor because I think that was a period when we were still in the game at 2-1 and when the Mee slip like calling, and I think we were a little bit lucky not to concede from that one, but then it was 3-1 pretty soon afterwards. Anyway, Kevin, I think the turning point for me in the second half was when we were getting back into the game after Boyd had scored from the corner. We scored from a corner, by the way. We've got to highlight that. After Boyd's goal, we had some pressure and Danny Ings put a header just wide. At 2-1, you think if he scores that chance, it's probably a different game.
I think saying that we scored from a corner is technically correct, but
I'm not sure how much we had to do with it. The goalkeeper did pretty much give us that one.
Yeah, it was it was hard not to score from that one. I think both strikers missed far too many, far too easy chances throughout the game. And you talk about turning points. That was potentially one. Particularly, you know, if he had scored that. We'd have come back from two down back to 2-2, and you'd think that at that stage the turf would have erupted into that cold and what we know it can do at certain when we've got that big something to really get behind. And obviously coming back from two goals down is something to really get excited about. And I honestly think if Ings had scored that, we would have gone on to win. As it was, the complete opposite happens. West Ham scoring meant it was flat. It was, if it wasn't game over already, it was definitely at that point then. But again, I don't think you can single out individual misses either, because I don't think that has any more significance than the ones that he and Duke missed in the first half. I think in the first half, particularly, Djokovic had two headers from a couple of yards out, which he just seemed to just walk towards and hope they'd hit his head and go in the right direction. He didn't seem to make any effort to try to get a header on target. He was just hoping he'd hit his head and go in. That was certainly a turning point, but I think that's only in hindsight, really. I think you can look at all the different misses in the same weight for me.
I think it's just, you're right when you say with hindsight you can look at that, but I think even at the time, the Ings header, to me, it felt like a key moment, and to me it seems like when these big moments come in games, that's where we've fallen short. Like a missed header at the back, a clearance that's not been dealt with properly, a chance like that when it's a key phase in the game, I think they are important moments, and that's where it's going wrong. The worst miss, by the way, I suppose it didn't really matter, it was so late in the game, but Ashley Barnes hitting the bar from 6 yards out, I can't believe more's not been made of that. It's a terrible, terrible miss. And yeah, I just can't believe you missed that one.
I think the only reason nothing's been made of it is just because everyone didn't really care at that point. Maybe, you know, it sounds a bit weird saying we didn't care, but I think it was just that stage where it was game over. I don't think really anyone really had any belief that we could get back into it at that point. And whereas I think the Ings one is more, sticks in my memory a bit more, because at that point we were in the game, we could have got back into it, we could have come back and won the match. Whereas the Barnes one was slightly less significant in that fact.
The Barnes one maybe just sums up our problems in front of goal. The chance as simple as that isn't being converted. Nathan, one positive to take from the game. We do want to try and come up with some positives, even though we lost again. The quality of crossing was much improved. You've already pointed out Boyd and Trippier in the first half, but Trippier in particular, I think, deserves to be singled out, because the quality of balls he was putting in was absolutely outstanding. He probably should have had 2 or 3 assists, and compared to a lot of his deliveries this season, there was a vast improvement there, wasn't there?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It was like the old Trippier of last season, you know, that could, you know, have a go at a defence and get by them and swing a really, you know, deadly ball in. And I was expecting more of the same this season, and it didn't really happen, and I'm a bit surprised by that. But, you know, on Saturday, it was kind of like the old Trippier that we knew and fell in love with last season. So that was, it was really good to see, and, you know, it was just a shame that he didn't get them to assist, because I think he deserved them, to be honest.
There's not much he can do if he's putting balls like that in on a plate for the strikers and they're still missing them. So, yeah, I think that's a positive sign that the quality of chances that we created was certainly the best that it's been all season, and it's got to be just a matter of time until strikers score. We can come on to that a little bit later. And we've got some comments from a West Ham fan who's contributed to the site in the last couple of weeks, Stuart Plant, who runs one of the West Ham fan sites, Iron Views. He was going to come on the podcast tonight, but he couldn't actually, so he sent us in some comments instead. I'll just read out what he said. Stuart said, "It was a comfortable win, but only in so much as you hit the post a few times, and had you had an informed Danny Ings, who knows, I thought Boyd looked like he will be a very tidy player for you. Carrying on our curse, he notched his first goal for Burnley against us. Having only seen the highlights, I wouldn't want to comment too arrogantly on the ease of our win, but it just seemed that he couldn't cope with balls into the box. First through our left back, then our right back, and then from a set piece." And Stuart also said, "You set us up perfectly in the first half, played well yourself while stifling our attacking threat. Again, with a better or just an informed Fuchs or Ings up front, I think it'll all become a lot easier for you." The striker problem, Kevin, it's now 8 games if you include the cup game, and none of them have scored a single goal. All 4 of our goals have come from wingers. It's not even close to being good enough, is it?
Not even close at all, no. I think the only striker that is playing, it's weird. The only striker who's actually playing well is Djokovic, but even he has been pretty rubbish in front of goal. Like I said, I really think he should have had at least 2 goals on Saturday, and it's one of those where if we're scoring lots of goals, then it's really great to have somebody like him. Who's playing that support role, and he can knock balls down, he can hold the ball, he can bring others into play, he can play out to the wide players and just be that presence in the box, and that's really, really valuable when you've got other players scoring around you. But when that's not happening and he's coming in and missing 2 or 3 big chances a game, then it becomes slightly troublesome, because I've been a big fan of Djokovic this season. I've defended him quite a lot. I've said it, I think he's been one of our better players. But it gets to a stage where we're not scoring goals, and we've got a striker who is missing lots of relatively easy chances for my liking. Then you've got Danny Ings, who has he scored a single goal since March? I'm not sure if he has.
He scored one at Reading in the last game of the season. That's right, his only one since March.
So he scored one since March, and in that time, for me, he's probably had 2 or 3 good games in that time as well. I got a bit of stick at the weekend for suggesting that he was having a quiet game against West Ham. But actually, if you look at people's comments after the game, you look at people's player ratings on message boards and comments on Twitter, and actually he's coming through a really rough time as well. A lot of people have been quite disappointed by his performance against West Ham. And of course, okay, he's had a month out, but prior to that he was poor as well. He's been poor at the end of last season. And it's trouble, because I actually had huge confidence that he was going to be a really, really good Premier League player, and I thought that him and Shackle would continue to play in the Premier League beyond this season, regardless of what happens to us. Because I thought they both had really kind of Premier League qualities, which they're the type of players that really stand out in this league. But there's obviously an issue with Ings somewhere. I don't know if it's confidence or frustration. I think at the end of last season, he certainly looked very very frustrated. He was almost snatching at chances, what he wouldn't do usually. He just doesn't seem to be playing like Danny Ings. He used to dominate games up top, and I think you've just seen him for flashes now, which I really don't know what's up with him, but it doesn't seem like Danny Ings to me. And then behind him, you've got Ashley Barnes, who... I think's an average at best Championship player. I was disappointed with him at the end of last season, really. And then Marvin Sordell, who runs about a lot.
Yeah, I don't think there's that much we can really say about Barnes and Sordell, just that there's certainly no other Premier League squad that they'll be anywhere near, and they're the options that we've got off the bench. It's just a sign of where we are and how much money we had to spend, I suppose, that's the quality of players that we've got in reserve. Nathan, we'll come to you on Ings as well. We could probably talk about Ings alone for an hour, but I did just want to pick out a tweet that you sent after the game on Saturday. You said, "The more I watch Ings play this season, the more I think he's just not that interested in staying at this club."
Yeah, I think... I just don't... He looks to be... It's hard to explain. I don't know. He just looks to be not interested. I know, you know, he's running around and he's going for chances, but You know, that's what he's paid to do. If he just stood still on the pitch, he'd be taken off after 5 minutes. So, you know, he's going to look half interested. But I think he's just itching for that move, really. He knows that we're not in the best situation to stay up. And, you know, I just think he wants that move. I think he's heard too much speculation of, you know, the likes. You know, I read today that Newcastle and Aston Villa are, you know, interested. And I think he just wants that move, to be honest. And to be honest, I don't think he's going the right way about it.
Well, we've talked a lot about Ings and his contract before, but the club's managed to keep it quite quiet. They've dampened the speculation about his future quite a lot. All that's been said is that he's happy to stay. And if you read between the lines there, it's quite clear that he's going to run his contract down. There was a story in the Mail on Sunday about Newcastle, Villa and Stoke all being interested in him at the end of the season. This is the first time, really, the media's picked up on it in a big way, and the speculation's obviously not going to help. Kevin, as much as we can say about Danny Ings' contract, we've probably said it before, but could it be that it's becoming more of a distraction? And Nathan's point about commitment and not going about it the right way, he's not going to get a big Premier League contract unless he excels this season.
Well, first of all, I think the first site to properly, to really explicitly announce that he was wanting to run down his contract was No Nay Never. Reading through the lines, whereas I think other publications were just happy to quote Sean Dyche. I think we were the first ones to actually say in black and white, Danny Ings is running down his contract. But I think whatever happens, if he goes at the end of his season, he's going to get quite a significant pay rise, I think, wherever he goes. Even if he goes to another top end championship club, because he, regardless of how he's done this season, he's still a proven, incredibly good championship striker. So even if he went to another top championship club, I think he's still probably going to get significant pay rise from what he's on at Burnley. I'm not sure I believe the rumours about the Newcastle and stuff. I don't know if that's just agent talks. It seems a bit of a weird time for that to come out because say he's not exactly setting the Premier League on fire at the moment.
Well, he'd been injured for a month. It's very strange timing for that story to come out.
It is, yeah, and particularly after being, he was quiet before. It's not like he scored a load of goals and then got injured. And it's one of those where if they were interested, what. I mean, I assume we might have heard about it before. I'm not sure. I think that's probably just agent talk. But it's certainly a distraction. It's one of those things where regardless of whether what's true, what's not true, it is another thing to beat him with. And it's not another one of those things where when he's not having a good time, when he's not playing well, it's another thing for the fans to bring up. It's just another thing to question him with. Which is not good for anybody, really. It's not good for the fans, because obviously we want to be watching players who we really believe want to play for the club. It's not good for Danny Ings, obviously, because I'm sure he doesn't want speculation about his commitment going round. It's not good for Sean Dyche, because I'm sure Sean Dyche wants a lot more harmony around the place, and it doesn't do anyone good. But I think that's not to say we shouldn't talk about it, because I think it's a valid question. It's something what should be asked and debated and discussed.
I don't want to gang up on Nathan, but well, yeah, I agree on commitment, but I think some of the comments Nathan got to that tweet were quite telling as well. I think someone said that Ings' activity on social media shows that he's dedicated to the club, because he's posted a couple of pictures on Instagram of him wearing a Burnley shirt. It just seemed like a very strange argument to say, oh, he's put this on Twitter, therefore he must be happy as a Burnley player. Yeah, and I also think we need to remember that Danny Ings hasn't got any particular affiliation to Burnley Football Club. I mean, we've done very well by him, but he's done very well by us as well, so it's worked out well for all parties so far, but I don't think anyone would really be too upset if he did go for nothing next summer and it'd be a tribunal anyway, because without him we wouldn't have got promoted. So we do need to remember that, and it's worth pointing out as well that everyone wants to see Danny Ings scoring goals for Burnley Football Club. It's not a case of everyone wanting him to fail. That's just a bit ridiculous. on the topic of strikers, our question of the week this week was about our strikers. Adam, you've got that for us now.
Yep. The question of the week this week was, is our attack cut out for the Premier League? Why and why not? The responses to that question were quite varied, as you can imagine. Richard Sutcliffe said, no Premier League goal-scoring experience. It might be worth mentioning to get that. To get that, though, would cost more than we have. Austin kind of agrees. He says, no, but we knew that before the season started. We signed players with no hint of a Premier League track record. Tom Whitaker says no, because they can't score a frigging goal in the Premier League.
That's fair.
Steve Kelly says probably. He disagrees with all the others. Ings and Vokes took Southampton apart last season in the Cup, so may do so again to similar teams.
In fairness, that was Southampton's reserves, so yeah, probably can't count that deputies. Much by that.
Yeah. Well, didn't we lose that game quite heavily?
Yeah, we cut them to shreds, but lost. Yeah.
Yeah. James Riley says he doesn't know, and Sam Vokes.
Thanks, James.
Sam Vokes isn't fit yet, but the midfield seemed to be able to chip in with a few goals. Neil Lavery, I think I've said that right, said no, that they aren't cut out for it. We signed bang average championship strikers with nothing in their recent record to think that they make the step up. Last few, Ben Ingham says if Ings had the work ethic and mentality of Trippier, he would have scored a few already. I like the Duke's work rate, unsure on quality. And that's about it.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's difficult to argue that they are cut out for the Premier League when none of them have scored yet, but there's probably a long way to go. Just on this question then, Nathan, do you think the Stratforth are good enough?
No.
Right, next.
I agree with most of the comments. I don't think any of the players have shown any evidence of them, you know, that they could make the step up. Like I think Kev mentioned earlier, that Ashley Barnes looked very mediocre like end of last season, if not below average. Marvin Sordell kind of just fell off the edge of the earth when he went to Bolton. The only real hope we had was Sam Vokes and Danny Ings, and one of them spent half of this season on the medical table, and the other half, he's kind of just not really done much. And Djukovic has just been a battering ram for me. He's just been a big, you know, bull in a china shop, but with no end product, and you know, it doesn't really look good on the goal scoring front unless, you know, the likes of Arfield, Boyd, Kightley and Wallace start scoring, you know, hat tricks every other week, then we're going to really struggle, I think.
That's probably unlikely if we're going to rely on Ross Wallace to get a hat trick every week. Djukovic, for me, we've talked a lot about him on the podcast before, but I agree with Kevin, I really like him, but I just can't help but feeling he's a downgrade on Sam Vokes. And when we knew Sam Vokes was going to be out until probably Christmas, I would have hoped that we'd have got a better player to replace him rather than a worse one. Kevin, you've already spoke at length on the strikers, but we already seem to be counting down for Sam Vokes to come back. But there's a lot of points to play for before then. We can't be too looking ahead to that one. We've got to work with what we've got at the moment.
Yeah, there's a few things on that. It's potential that, you know, we're well adrift by the time Vokes comes back. But I think even beyond that, there's a lot of people putting a lot of expectation on Sam Vokes. There's a really weird thing I'm seeing along with Burnley fans at the moment, is that there's the words faith and trust are coming up quite a lot. And a lot of people just seem to be just waiting for it to happen. People have got a lot of faith that everything's going to come good eventually. And I think that applies to Sam Vokes as well. I think a lot of people are thinking, okay, we're not doing too well now, but as soon as Sam Vokes comes back, we'll be back to usual. And it's a lot of pressure to put on this guy's head, particularly in that we've got problems throughout the other areas of the pitch as well. And you've also got to remember that Sam Vokes is also unproven at this level. And similarly, he will have been out for a long, long time. It's going to take him a good few months to get back into into his rhythm. I think he's hoping to be back in full training in about 3 weeks. So you can probably expect him to be in full training for a month before he gets back onto the pitch. And then it's going to take him another month or two to get back to being like Sam Vokes. And at that point, you're getting towards the end of the season. So he's probably only going to have a handful of games where he's going to be at full... He's going to be able to put... Adam can edit that sentence out. But there's only going to be a handful of games when he's going to be at his best, really. So I think we should pretty much discount Vokes from the conversation, really, because I don't think it's going to be that much of a difference.
I think it's also important to say, I'm breaking with tradition by coming in here. My voice has finally been heard.
Adam Howarth on the No Name Ever podcast, everyone. He's only interested now. It's an award-nominated No Name Ever podcast. Yeah. Like, I'm going to talk now.
I think it's important to say that when important players get injured, a lot of expectation gets placed on them, and they get built up to be something that they're really not. It happened with Chris McCann a few seasons ago, and you can kind of see it happening here that Sam Vokes turns into this messiah that's got the talents of Messi, and then he comes back and lo and behold, he's not actually a saviour after all, and he may improve the side, but it's kind of foolish to say that he'll be like a one-size-fits-all solution to the problems that we're having.
Yeah, it's not going to be like a giant sticking plaster that makes all the problems go away, is it? I mean, I think Kevin's right that we can't expect that much from him. He's similar to a lot of the players. He's still quite a young player. He's going to be playing in the Premier League for the first time, and he's got a serious, potentially career-ending injury to come back from. So I think anything that we get from Sam Vokes this season has just got to be treated as a bonus. And yeah, I don't think we can be like, it'll all be fine when Sam Vokes is back. But on the flip side, if I can just argue against myself for a moment, I do think when Sam Vokes plays, we are a much better team. And that's not just because Vokes is a better player than Jukic. I think he suits our style better. And I think he improves the players around him, similar to how Stephen Thompson used to when he used to play up front for us. So I can see why people are excited about him coming back. But yeah, I think it's fair to point out that there's a lot of points to play for before then, and yeah, we could be cut off at the bottom of the league before that happens. So let's not get too excited about Sam Vokes coming back, because it could yet be quite a while away.
I think just one last thing, I think, for me is just, I think this expectation's come from a last ditch attempt at actually having a striker that's going to put goals in, and I think people are just kind of hoping that that's going to happen. And you know, it's just like blind faith that he'll just come back angrier and stronger and fitter and better than ever, like a Rocky moment, and he's just going to come back and on his first game, like, score the winner in the 90th minute, and everything will be forgotten about, and we'll just stay up and it'll be a miracle. And I think a lot of people just need to kind of, you know, have Kev's opinion. I'm not saying, you know, not adopt Kev's opinion, but just realistically think about it, that you know, it's going to be a long journey back, and it's going to be difficult.
I think you're right. I think it's hope, isn't it, more than anything else?
I think you can say that about pretty much everything, that everyone should have my opinion. I think my opinion is right on everything.
Do we even do this podcast?
Yeah, the podcast next week. Like me. the podcast next week will just be Kev talking for an hour.
It's a monologue.
And then everyone will agree with him, and then everything will be great.
It's turning into something really dystopian and Big Brother-ish.
it's the Eagles. It's because of the award. We're all out of control now.
Well, welcome to No Name Never 1984 edition.
That's why we've become a finalist, you know. People don't think we're good. We've just told them they have to think
we're good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Ministry of Truth. We've rewritten all the rubbish that we've talked over the years and made people talk.
Why do you think I edit the podcast?
Just on the awards, this is probably as good a time as any to mention it. Faultless segue there from the NNNT. That's an award-nominated segue for you. The FBA is, if you've managed to avoid hearing us talk endlessly about this for the last few weeks anyway, is the Football Blogging Awards, and we are nominated for the first time this year. The podcast is up for the Best Podcast Award, and about 3,000 blogs and bloggers were nominated, so this is quite a big deal. People have voted for us in their droves already, and we're hugely grateful for that to get us into the final 10, but there's some excellent podcasts that we are up against, so we do need people to vote again. All the details are on the website about how you can vote. The address is nonaneever.net/FBAs, and you can vote on Twitter, on Facebook, and through their website, and you can do that once through each. So anything that you can do to help us get that prize would be appreciated, and we're all very excited about going to Manchester for a big piss up for the award ceremony next month. Anyway, now that that little pug's done with, news came out today that there's going to be an England game at Turf Moor, which is, I'm very excited about this, although reaction on Twitter was a little bit more mixed. It'll only be a friendly, but I suppose with half the squad coming from the Burnley squad anyway, I suppose it makes sense to have it at Turf Moor. Shell Byrings and Keane should all be involved. Kevin, surely it's great exposure for the club as much as anything to have a big international game at Turf Moor.
To be honest, I don't really care.
Brilliant.
I think the only thing we'll benefit from is I'm assuming the FA are renting the ground from us. Yeah, sort of. And that, I couldn't really care less. To be honest.
Excellent. So that's Kevin's opinion that everyone can disagree with that one. Nathan, please tell me you're looking forward to this game. Tickets are only a tenner. It sounds like an absolute bargain to me.
I'm really excited, actually. It's I think it's a testament to how much the club have done to get Turf Moor into a position where it can host international friendlies. You know, when you think about it like that, the FA actually looked to us and thought, actually, Turf Moor is a suitable place that England under-21s will play Portugal under-21s. You know, at the moment, two very, very good under-21 side that probably are expected to go quite a long way in the next tournament. So I'm very excited to see this game. I'll definitely be going.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting just to see some other players, and we might get to see some strikers who are good. It'll make
a bit of a change. Goals
yeah, exactly. It should be quite interesting. But yeah, like I say, Shell, Barkeen and Ings, you don't expect to be involved in that squad. It's worth remembering, actually, back in the day when England B played at Turf Moor. I was on this game, I remember. Alan Smith and Stuart Downing were playing for England B. So in 2007, England beat Albania. And there was a certain Besart Berisha who was on the show, who we signed as a result of looking really good in that game. So, you know, possibly we'll sign a Portuguese player no one's heard of, and they'll turn out to be rubbish as well. So it'll be worth going just to see that, I think. I don't think Ronaldo will be playing, though, so we can probably discount that. We've still got a bit of time left on tonight's podcast, so we can look ahead to next weekend's game, which is again at home. Everton, the visitors to Turf Moor, games on Sunday in front of the Sky cameras. I suppose, Kevin, looking ahead at the games that we had in this little run after the international break, these back-to-back home games looked really important for getting that first win, didn't they? And even though Everton were improved at the weekend and won, that's still got to be an opportunity to get that result, surely.
Yeah, well, certainly after Leicester, you went into these games thinking, okay, we can get that win now. Before the weekend, I looked at the games and thought, okay, West Ham's probably the most winnable of these games. And although we've come out of that feeling disappointed and with confidence slightly dented, there are positives to take away from that, and lots of things to be encouraged by. I think the way we went forward as a team was very good. Our crossing was finally excellent. And if we can improve the finishing and cut out some of the mistakes at the bottom, we've got the bases of a decent team. Everton have had some poor results this season. They'll be disappointed to be in the bottom half. But they've got some very, very good quality players in there. And they only just missed out on the top. Well, they were just outside the top four last season. So we certainly can't be complacent that they're going to be a poor team again. I think they're just waiting for everything to click. almost in a similar way to what we are, but on a very different degree. So it's going to be a difficult game. I don't think we'll get anywhere near as many chances as we got against West Ham. So we've got to make sure that the few chances we do get, we've got to take advantage of a lot more than we did on Saturday.
It's worth pointing out the West Ham, the West Ham's fixtures this season, their results have been much better than anyone was really expecting. They went fourth after beating us, so they're clearly the makings of a very good team. But yeah, at home you'd still expect us to probably get something from that. Nathan, Everton have got a trip to Lille in the whatever the Europa League thing's called this year. That's probably going to have an impact, isn't it? Everton have struggled a little bit in their Premier League games after European games this season.
Yeah, I think that's and it's a good thing to think about, and I'd forgot about, to be honest. But yeah, I think it's I think that'll do us a favour, that they might be a bit tired, a bit jet-lagged, and they've got a few days, but you know, especially if we hit them as quick as we did against West Ham, you know, we might actually get that early goal and it might actually set us up for the rest of the game. But I think looking back at the West Ham game and how the wing-backs operated against us and how they pretty much killed the game off for us, we have to be really extra careful against Everton, because they've got, in my opinion, one of the best in the game at the moment, and we have to really look at stopping that and stopping goals like that against us.
That's a very good point. It was fullbacks did the damage in the West Ham game, Jenkinson and Cresswell, and Everton's two, Coleman and Baines, are arguably the best in the league, so that was certainly a threat to look out for. But up front as well, Everton have got plenty of talent. We've got a choice of Lukaku and Eto'o, which isn't a bad choice for Martinez to have to make. And also, Ross Barkley's back, isn't it? I suppose it'll be exciting to see Barkley on the turf.
Yeah, definitely. He's up there with one of my favourite and most exciting players at the moment. He kind of breathes a bit of hope into England and that setup. But yeah, it should be good to see him, and hopefully we can kind of put him a peg down or two, and see if we can try and contain him. See if David Jones can put him in his back pocket.
I suppose an early goal is going to be absolutely vital, isn't it, Kevin? We've already talked about the West Ham game, and if the Boyd shot right at the start had gone in, then it could have all been different. And we've only scored the first goal once against Chelsea, and although that didn't work out for us, it might make a difference if we can get our noses in front.
Yeah, I think we've only been leading in games for about, I don't know how long we were in the lead for Chelsea, but it only felt like...
Not long at all.
5-10 minutes, something like that. So all season we've been leading for only a couple of minutes. And I think if you look at the way we fell apart almost against West Ham, I think it's got to be telling just how important that first goal was for West Ham. In that we were playing so well, they got our first goal. Then they seemed to score another one straight after it. And then obviously we went and got the third one as well. And I think there's been a couple of times this season where we've conceded two goals in succession quite quickly. So it's obviously having an effect. I think when that first goal goes in, it's not us. Our heads are dropping slightly. So if we can get our first goal, hopefully it will give us that real big boost. And we can start to have a bit of belief in ourselves a little more. Because I think I think as soon as our first goal's gone in against us, a few times we've looked like we don't believe in ourselves as much. So if we can get an early goal, quite early on in the game, get our heads up a bit more, think, you know, we can win this, we will win this. That could be really big for us. I think that was one of the things at the start of our last Premier League campaign against, you know, the likes of United and Everton. We scored these big early goals, and then we looked really strong. We especially again the turf. I think we can get an early goal. I was talking about how early, if England could score that goal to make it 2-2, the turf would have been kind of erupted and would have been really behind us. I think that would happen again if we were to get an early goal against Everton. I think the turf would probably turn from a muted turf more into a at least slightly less muted turf more, and really almost hopefully shout us on to give us that extra belief and hopefully go on and get the result we need.
I see what you mean about the heads dropping a little bit, because we haven't really come back into games after going down. The last couple of games sort of contradict that, that we fought back at Leicester and got two equalisers, and then even though we lost the West Ham game, there was a period when we were on top again and could have got that equaliser. So I think we can take a bit of confidence from that, even though we didn't get the results we were.
But we did score five. After. We did concede 5 minutes after the opener, though. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, that's very true. I mean, at Leicester they scored again as we were still celebrating, so that's obviously not ideal. Nathan, give us a prediction for the Everton game then.
I'm going to go for a 1-1 draw.
I think we'd probably take that, wouldn't we? I mean, this first win's important, but we need to start getting points on the board as well.
Realistically, a point against Everton, who are a very good team, just Olioria is just out of form at the moment, but a point against Everton at home, I'd take that every day of the week.
I think the concern is then that the next game is Arsenal away, and we could be looking at 9 games without that first win. Kevin, what's your prediction?
That is definitely the concern, because normally you would be happy, like Nathan says, with a point against Everton at home. But it's getting to that stage where now where draws aren't really good enough. And particularly, like you say, when we're following that up with the likes of Arsenal, it's just extending that time without a win. I want to be hopeful and say a 1-0 win, but I'm going to go for a 1-0 draw as well, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think it might be a draw as well. I really hope we can get that first win, and I do think the first goal is going to be absolutely vital, but I just can't see it at the minute. I think defensively we look a bit too open, and the goal scoring problem is obviously massive. We've scored 3 in the last 2 games, which is good, but we've conceded 9 in the last 3, so it's just a sign for me that we don't really seem cut out for the Premier League, and that's quite a negative and downbeat way to leave this week's Known and Ever podcast. If you've got any feedback at all, please do let us know. The email address for anything podcast related is podcast@knownandever.net. And a reminder that we are up for an FBA for Best Football Podcast. So if you have enjoyed the show, please do consider taking a second to vote for us. All the details are on the site at knownandever.net/FBAs. And thanks as well to our sponsors at Neville G, without whom we couldn't do the website or the podcast either. So guests this week have been Nathan and Kevin. If you don't want to be guests as well, please do get in touch. But that's all we've got time for this week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.